Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Buzzkillers, one of the biggest, most powerful people in world history was Genghis Khan. He eventually created the largest empire the world had ever seen. He's known to be a ruthless leader. He's known to be a ruthless conqueror. But what was he really like? And what are the genuine stories about him? And what stories have been laid on afterwards, long after his death? Well, for the first time in the show, we're about to go on the Intersphere and do a long, long distance interview with a historian, an expert on Genghis Khan. His name is Professor John Giebfried from St. Louis University. And in about 30 seconds, we're going to zip over via the Intersphere and talk to him. Keep your fingers crossed, Buzzkillers. I'm not very good with new technology, but here goes. So as I said, we're here to talk today with Dr. John Giebfried. John holds a PhD in medieval history with an expertise particularly in the Mongol invasions and the Crusades. He currently teaches at St. Louis University and is soon to be a postdoctoral fellow at Hebrew University of Jerusalem. How are you, Professor?
I'm glad to be here. I've been a huge fan of the show basically since it began, so I'm honored to be a guest today.
Well, as I said, we're here to talk about Genghis Khan because he's a figure that has many myths associated with him, including perhaps even his name.
Yeah. In fact, Genghis Khan's not his name at all. It's his title. His birth name was Temujin, so that's what his mom would call him. Derives from the word temur, meaning iron. So some say it's because maybe he comes from a family of blacksmiths, which we don't have any record of, or maybe it just means he's strong as iron. But Genghis Khan is only a title he takes later in life when he sort of completes phase one of his world conquest plan by uniting all the tribes of the Central Asian steppe together.
Oh, okay. So then what does the title Genghis Khan mean?
Well, Genghis is an anglicization of Chinggis, which is what a 13th century Mongol would have actually called him. So there's actually a debate about what Chinggis Khan actually means. We all agree on Khan. It just means ruler. Yeah. And that's used by rulers both before and after him. There's two schools about Chinggis. One says that it means firm or fierce or strong. So he'd be the firm ruler or the great ruler, or the strong ruler. Another, which the philologists say is more etymologically correct, is that Chinggis means ocean or oceanic or maybe widespreading, kind of spreading out over the world like an ocean, spreading his empire out. He is the ruler of he's the ruler of this wide stretching almost ocean-sized empire.
Okay, well, that sort of makes sense. But I understand that there's also confusion about who the people he ruled over were and where they were.
Yeah, so this is a bigger problem the further you go back in history. And it's really a medieval myth that sort of now just sort of become archaic, and you still see it in sort of old books today, and that they talk about Genghis Khan and the Tartar horde, and how the Mongols are, they use the term Tartars to describe them. I should note that there is a tribe called the Tatars, so there's only one R, so T-A-T-A-R as opposed to T-A-R-T-A-R. And that this tribe is hanging out in Mongolia, but they are not the Mongols, and they don't get along very well with the Mongols. Actually, Temujin, later Genghis Khan's father, was murdered by the Tatars. And as a response in 1202, when Temujin gets his revenge, he massacres the entire Tatar aristocracy and assimilates all the commoners into the Mongol tribe.
He massacres them. That's harsh.
Yeah, it's. But this is what he does to all the tribes on the steppe. That what he wants to do is unite all the sort of the tribes of Greater Mongolia together into what he called an empire of all those who live in felt tents. All these sort of traditional nomadic peoples who live on sort of the plains that stretch sort of across Eurasia from Mongolia sort of all the way across to Ukraine and Central Asia. That this is sort of the intention he has, to unite them all under the Mongol banner.
Huh. Okay. So we know where they were, but what does the term Tartar, or where does the term Tartars actually come from?
So it's interesting that this is medieval Europeans making this mistake. So in ancient Greek mythology, the hell that the Titans, the enemies of the gods of Olympus, were tossed into is Tartarus. That's actually the place that Sisyphus is perpetually pushing the ball, the stone up the hill, only for it to fall back down again. So this is the hell of, this is sort of ancient Greek hell, slightly different but associated with Hades. So when they hear about these people, these Mongols ravaging through sort of the known world, destroying everyone in their wake, they hear this and they've heard that there are people called Tartars in that part of the world, and they kind of conflate this all together. And Tartar sounds, or Tatar sounds like Tartarus, and so the Mongols are coming sort of directly out of hell, which explains their worldview.
Yeah, and it is certainly, that's not a very flattering name.
Yeah, actually, the Mongols didn't like it at all. I mean, these are one of your like arch rivals that you killed off. So we actually have Mongol records of them correcting Europeans who call them Tartars. I imagine it would be something like if the Native Americans ran into a bunch of Irish people in the New World and called them English. I mean, there's a lot of like hatred, right, yeah. And you just confuse them. It's that maybe it makes sense in their language, but it doesn't really help. It really doesn't help, and is not flattering when you call someone something that's kind of sort of close, but has a bad history of being wrong.
Right, right. Well, that's a wonderful overview of the place and the people. Can we back up a little bit and give us a, can you back up a little bit and give us a brief overview of Genghis Khan's career?
All right. This is trying to talk about the person who builds the largest land empire in world history is very difficult to do quickly, but I'll do my best. So he begins as the son of a minor steppe ruler. From a little sub-clan of the Mongols. So his dad isn't even the head of the Mongols. He's the head of, like, one of the important Mongol families. Father is killed by the Tatars. Young Temujin has to run off into the wilderness. And over a period of decades, he one by one defeats all his enemies, unites all the nomadic peoples of Greater Mongolia under his rule, which he finally succeeds in 1206. From there, he goes on a huge whirlwind campaign, conquering the northern part of China, Central Asia, Persia, before dying from his wounds, suffered in a hunting accident while conquering sort of yet another part of China. After he dies, his sons and his grandsons continue to expand the empire into sort of this largest empire in world history, taking over all of China, Korea, almost all of the Middle East and Eastern Europe, going as far west as Budapest in modern Hungary and also into Poland.
Yeah, we should remind buzzkillers, you know, we tend to think of modern empires as being so massive, but this is, in terms of land empires anyway, this is unbelievably massive. What myth do we have about Genghis himself?
I say, like many figures, there's sort of two competing images of Genghis. You have this old school myth that he is sort of this mass murdering, uncivilized sort of barbarian who's just going to end sort of the civilized world as we know it. And then we have the reactionary myth, I guess you'd call it, that he is this modern, sophisticated, ecumenical sort of proto-feminist person who, despite the death, is sort of a champion of free trade and all that's good and way ahead of his time.
Well, those are pretty differing views. Then again, all conquerors, Napoleon, Alexander, they produce very similar dichotomies of opinion.
Exactly. He is the classic world conqueror when it comes to split opinions.
Well, let's take that barbarian image first. Can you help us by deconstructing that, unpacking it, and let us and tell us more about it?
All right. So the first thing we should talk about is the fact that people have this image of the Mongols as winning just because of numbers, that they're these massive hordes of men that they're just sending in, and they're not winning because of any sort of superior tactical advantage. And that for most of the time in Genghis Khan's career, he was outnumbered by his enemies. Actually, I think in every sort of campaign he ever fought, he was outnumbered by the people he was attacking. That being said, he normally had more horses than the people he was attacking.
Oh, so were horses the difference? Were they the key to his success?
Yes. Like all sort of steppe armies, all these sort of central nomadic armies, people dating back even sort of as far as the Huns, that the basic element of the army is sort of the mounted horse archer. And okay. The advantage of this is you maximize mobility and firepower. A Mongol warrior always had 3 to 5 horses, so you could have extras in case your horse got really tired or your horse was killed out from under you. And they also had this sort of great hybrid bow. It's called a double recurve bow. It has sort of the advantages and range of a long bow and of sort of the penetration of a short bow. And so it's a very good, perfect weapon.
We're going to try to get a good image of that to put on the website for the Buzzkillers. So what else made them, Genghis Khan and the rest of his group, the better conquerors than past conquerors like, say, the Huns?
Well, one of the things he did is he set up this sort of proto-military academy in which was tied to his central headquarters in Mongolia to help train Mongol commanders. He also was a pioneer in a decimalized organization system. So you have units of 10, which there are 10 of them in a unit of 100, and then you have units of 100 and 10 of them in units of 1,000, and then units of 1,000 and 10,000, and sort of a very organized army. So he could send, pass orders up and down the chain of command and have sort of more mobility and flexibility. He also managed tactics such as sort of the feigned retreat, which is where you run up to your enemy, you wait for that, and then you look like you're retreating because they've inflicted some blow on you. And then you retreat back, but your real goal is you just get them to try to chase you as you retreat. And so they break their defensive formations, and then you turn around saying, ha ha ha, we weren't actually afraid of you, but now you're out of formation, so we can get rid of the advantage of your formation. He also was a fan of a tactic called the arrow storm, where you just rain down arrows on your opponents that is sometimes probably hyperbolically, but not that hyperbolically said, that they could shoot off enough arrows that you would almost block out the sun. Wow. And in a tactic that later proponents of Blitzkrieg would take, that he would always try for a double envelopment, which is you send one part of your army around on the left, one on the right, and you just sort of encircle your enemy. And then because you're a horse archer, you're just riding around them all in a giant circle, firing arrows down, and there's basically nothing they can do with it. And when you did lose to the Mongols, he would incorporate you and your technology and your skills into his army. So siege engineers are a good example. That the Mongols have problems besieging cities early on, but they capture sort of Chinese and Arab siege engineers bring them into the fold, and they become experts at siege warfare. You also have a tendency by Genghis Khan to defer to great generals, people like Jebe or Subutai, who are not related to him, sometimes come from rival tribes, But if you're a good commander, you'll rise to the top, even over some of his own children.
Well, this sounds very modern, very, very sophisticated. He's got lots of different ideas, lots of different tactics. Certainly the decimalization sounds very modern. Where does this reputation, his reputation and the Mongols' reputation as brutal conquerors come from?
Well, the Mongols have a very clear policy when it comes to their enemies, and especially enemy cities. You were given a choice to surrender the city or to be killed. And if you didn't surrender, Genghis Khan made sure to exact a terrible price on those cities who didn't.
Oh, what are some examples of that?
The worst devastation is in modern-day Iran. During Genghis's invasion of the Khwarizmian Sultanate, the cities of Merv and Nishapur were totally depopulated. And a medieval Persian chronicler set the death total in the cities at 700,000 and 1.7 million, respectively.
Uh-huh. That seems unbelievably large. 1.7 million?
It is unbelievable, but overestimates of army size and casualty numbers are just a chronic problem in ancient and medieval sources dating Herodotus. I mean, he talks about the ancient Greek Herodotus talking about the Persian invasion of ancient Greece in the Battle of Thermopylae, puts together a Persian army of something like 5 million men. Just in pre-modern times, people... You can't get a good head count, so people guess and people exaggerate, especially when they're on. When you're winning, you want to exaggerate about how big an army you lost to. And when you're losing, you
mean
want
how
to
big an army
overestimate.
You
excuse me?
You mean how big an army you defeated?
Yes, you're right.
Yeah,
sorry.
Right.
Yeah, my apologies. You want to lie on both ends. if you win, you want to say you defeated a bigger army, and if you lose, you want to lose to a bigger army to say, "Hey, I was hopeless anyways." Nevertheless, despite these sort of unbelievably large numbers, that sort of modern historians would say that these attacks were still massive in the context of their times. And some historians have said that basically up to 50% of the population in areas that the Mongols conquered were killed when you count sort of indirect death from disease and starvation. But when they do get into cities, there are widespread massacres, and in the cities I mentioned before, Merv and Nishapur, the Mongols actually sort of built pyramids of skulls out of of all the people they killed and left it as a monument to, this is what happens when you try to defy the will of Genghis Khan.
Okay, so in some ways it sounds like they deserve their reputation as brutal conquerors.
The thing is, they do, but so do most ancient and medieval armies employ this similar sort of surrender or die policy. And such massacres are not out of the ordinary in this period from non-Mongol conquerors. Compare this to when the First Crusade marches into Jerusalem. There's widespread sort of bloodshed amongst the Muslim and Jewish population of the city. The reason that more people die in these Mongol sieges is because the Mongols are very effective in taking cities and conquer lots and lots of cities. I should mention that terror as a military tactic for the Mongols is really sort of a bedrock of how they win, that they are outnumbered by the settled countries that they're trying to take. They're facing large cities, and sort of horse archers aren't really a useful weapon in conquering a city, that horse archers can't man battering rams or put up ladders. It's not their tactic. And so the Mongols would be wasting an army of sort of specialists at one thing to attack these cities. So they need to compel most of the cities to surrender, or else they would lose all their men and they couldn't continue their conquests. So in this sort of campaign in modern day Iran, what they do is they attack the smaller cities first. And they leave the capital of Samarkand sort of for last. And the idea is If they destroy some of the smaller cities, it means the survivors who manage to make it out go and report back that, oh no, we tried to fight against Genghis Khan, and now my uncle and my brother and my wife, their skulls are in a giant pyramid outside the ruins of a destroyed city. And that will encourage the next bigger city they come to, maybe we should surrender to these Mongols.
To scare them. Scare them into surrendering. Yeah,
and that's the goal. It's sort of a brutal pragmatism that they're not destroying cities as a form of sort of indiscriminate violence. They're doing it because it's the most pragmatic way to keep their conquests going.
Hmm. Okay, so what's the other side of the coin, the revisionist view of the Mongols?
So let's start with sort of freedom of religion in the empire. This is another case of sort of Mongol pragmatism and also sort of Mongol apathy. That unlike a lot of, I mean, this is the time of the Crusades, other people in their time period, the Mongols were very laissez-faire about religion, that there was free exercise of religion in the Mongol Empire, as long as you also sort of prayed for the Great Khan. And that Genghis Khan and his successors, I guess the best way to describe it is an all of the above religious insurance policy. So let's have some Christians praying for us. Let's have some Muslims praying for us. Let's have some Buddhists praying for us, some Taoists. I don't know who's right. I'm not going to get involved in theology to know if Christians or Jews or Muslims or Buddhists are more right. Yeah. Although there are some interesting religious debates that they set up for this. But as long as they're all praying for you, one of them has to be right.
That's fascinating. Well, that laissez-faire attitude reminds me that there's this kind of opinion of free trade in the Mongol Empire as well.
Yeah, and by uniting the whole of the Silk Road under one empire, they really opened up opportunities for merchants from Europe to China.
Oh, by the way, where does the term Silk Road come from anyway?
Actually, it was coined by a 19th century German geographer by the name of Ferdinand von Richthofen. And if that name sounds familiar, he's actually the uncle of the famous World War I pilot Manfred von Richthofen, the Red Baron, who is the leading fighter ace of World War I. So there's a little history connection there.
And I think we've either done a show or a mini myth on the Red Baron, but if not, we'll do another one. Well, that's fascinating. It shows these connections over the centuries. But back to the Mongol trade empire. How did they encourage trade? They get credit for encouraging trade. How did they do that?
The Mongol Khans, especially after Genghis, are responsible for this, as they sort of push further into Russia and the Middle East and get closer to Europe. By the time in sort of the generation after Genghis, what you have is sort of a pro-trade attitude that they will let merchants stop in the Pony Express style outposts that are used by the Mongol postal system. The Mongols have this network to allow messages to get from one side to the other of their empire.
Again, sounds very modern. That sounds in itself sounds extremely modern.
Yeah.
Or modernizing.
They give some merchants sort of like the polos they have. Marco Polo and his family, they get these sort of gold tablets that give them safe passage. So attacking these merchants is equivalent to attacking the Great Khan himself. So no one's going to mess with them. They also help trade by providing a market that they wanted because they're rich and powerful. Luxury goods from all over the world. Fine silks from China, spices from India, incense from the Middle East, sort of fine cloth and jewels from Europe. You bring it all together. And all these merchants meet in the Mongol capital in Karakorum, and they say, "Hey, oh, you want to do some deals?" And they provide this sort of market. I think probably the biggest advantage they have is that under the Mongols, the tax rate is relatively low. One of the reasons for this is because there's now just one empire collecting taxes, whereas if before you had to leave China and pay Chinese taxes and then go through all the little states along the Silk Road all mm-hmm. the way to Europe, paying extra taxes on imports and exports and selling things all along the way. And so if you were a European merchant before the Mongol conquest, if you wanted to buy some Chinese silk, you would go to one of the Muslim-controlled sort of endpoints on the Silk Road, like the city of Alexandria. And in the end, the markup you're paying on that Chinese silk is 33% in tariffs. Wow. And that's if you're not just totally banned because the Muslims there say, oh, we're not going to trade with Christians now, which occasionally does happen. Whereas once the Mongol conquests take place, you can now, as an Italian merchant, go to Mongol Crimea, and the effective tax rate on getting that silk from China is now around 3-5%. So you're going from 33% sort of markup to 3.3-5% markup. And that sort of encourages trade because now a whole lot more people can afford goods and trade flows a lot more easily.
Okay. Well, another aspect I've heard about these sort of new research and new interpretations of Genghis Khan and the Mongols is about women in the empire, women in the Khan court.
So let's not pretend that Genghis Khan is a sort of feminist in any modern sense of the world, or that he cared about sort of the rights of women and respected them, that his army was sort of as brutal to conquered women as a lot of armies have been in the history of the world. What's different comparatively is the place of female Mongol royalty. And that Genghis Khan's daughters and granddaughters and the queens of the Mongol Empire are incredibly powerful. And at two occasions in the 13th century, you have women who are ruling the Mongol Empire in an interregnum between sort of different Mongol empires. Basically, the men haven't gotten it together to figure out who should be in charge. So you have the wives of the previous kings sitting around and running the empire while the men are trying to play politics. They're holding everything together. And if any of your listeners are interested in this, I'd recommend Jack Weatherford's book, The Secret History of Mongol Queens, How the Daughters of Genghis Khan Rescued His Empire, which is a good read for a sort of a popular book.
Yeah, well, we'll put it on the Buzzkill bookshelf and we'll have it there. So it seems to me like Genghis Khan is like so many conquerors in history. It's too complicated to label as a good guy, too complicated to label simply as a bad guy. It's a lot of modernizing things, a lot of things that don't seem modernizing or progressive. One of the things that is so fascinating about the persistence of Khan in the sort of popular imagination is, and I hate to bring up Facebook at this stage, but you always see these sort of semi or pseudo serious post saying that everybody's descended from Genghis Khan or everyone's descended from the Mongols. If you go back in time, you know, genetically, everybody, at least in Europe anyway, has some sort of Mongol DNA in them somewhere. Is there any truth to this? Are all European peoples descended from Genghis Khan?
This is a story that comes, I guess it's an exaggeration of something that is true. And there was a research study done back in 2003, which this all comes from. I particularly like the headline that the newspaper, The Guardian in London, put out for this, which is, "We owe it all to super stud Genghis." and it talks about how that Genghis Khan has 16 million male relatives alive today. So what this international research team did is they looked at the Y chromosomal DNA. So the DNA that everyone inherit or every man inherits from his father. Right. And so if you look at that DNA, there are in that chromosome, you can sort of trace back your father's 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 father all the way back up and try to figure out where that comes. And they noticed in studying, particularly in Mongolia and Central Asia, that there seems to be this one common ancestor living a little after the year 1000, that lots and lots of people are all share as a common descendant. And they said, what could this be? And they said, this is probably Genghis Khan. They're probably right. Well, partially.
Oh, okay.
It's actually the common descendant is probably like Genghis Khan's great, great grandfather. Further back. And that it's not probably these people aren't all direct descendants of Genghis Khan. They're descendants of Genghis Khan or his any of his brothers or half brothers, any of his uncles, his cousins, anyone in sort of the central Mongol elite would all sort of share this sort of Y chromosomal DNA. The team that looked at this sort of took 2,000 sort of samples and sort of extrapolated out the numbers. So they said that they came up with this figure of sort of 16 million men. But if you look at the clustering of it, for one, 16 million men is not a huge number when you consider a global population of, what are we, about 7 billion? You have a case, and these are clustered primarily in Mongolia, in Central Asia, places like Afghanistan and Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. And when they sort of expand your search into China and sort of further into sort of Russia or Eastern Europe, as you were saying, the Middle East, the percentage of direct male descendants of Genghis Khan is actually negligent. Negligible. Sorry,
it could be negligent to be descended from Genghis Khan.
Negligible percentages.
So the myth is not true. That you're not descended
that
from
all.
Genghis Khan, but you're probably not descended. We're probably not descended from Genghis Khan individually, but we're also we're descended from so many people. When you go back that far, you know, it's not like I have a stronger Genghis Khan gene than other people. You know, it's all by the time it gets to the 21st century, so diluted.
Yeah, and after they did this study, a lot of other sort of similar studies were done to look for sort of similar sort of Y chromosomal lines. That they found one in Ireland where most Irish people have this sort of this O'Neill descendancy,
right?
From
the O'Neill dynasty,
and going back that way, and there's this sort of Manchu line in China, the later Qing dynasty, that they have a Y descendants there. That if you look around, there are all these sort of Y chromosomal lines that exist. And in defense of Genghis Khan and his descendants, that because it's Y chromosome DNA, we can't count any of his female descendants or any of his male descendants, female descendants. So any kids that Genghis Khan's daughters or granddaughters had also sort of don't count, because as long as you don't have... So the number of direct descendants of Genghis Khan is probably bigger than 16 million, but it's not quite everyone in the world.
Right. Yeah, if you can't count the female chromosome, that sounds like it's almost a useless statistic.
Yeah. It's the best we can do with modern genetics.
Well, yeah. Okay. Well, we're going to ask the Buzzkillers now to email us at info@professorbuzzkill.com to tell us how strongly they think they're connected to Genghis Khan genetically and through their ancestors. Listen, Professor, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much. When you talked about Marco Polo earlier on the show, this kind of reminded me we've wanted to examine him for a long time. Would you be willing to come back on the show and talk about him?
Oh, I'd be glad to. Marco is a nice font of myths that I would love to help Buzzkill with you.
Okay, that's great. Well, we'll get back on the Intersphere and have you back on the show as soon as possible. Thanks again.
Bye. Thanks a lot. I really enjoyed it.
Okay, Buzzkillers. Talk to you next week.